You're listening to the Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast, where we talk about hunting, politics, sports, and everything in between. Now, here's your host, Steve West.
Everybody, welcome to Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast. You know, we've had a little bit of a lull here since we recorded our last one. Travis has been off too.
Yeah, I've been MIA.
Yeah, he went to Canada a few times, did some spring bear hunts.
Yeah, that little fishing. Fun.
Yeah, we'll do an update on that one in another podcast, you know, in the future, you know. But, you know, he was gone. I was busy. Got a lot of projects going on at the ranch and everything. And just kind of pulls us away from the studio. And, you know, it's one of those things where we all get back together. And it's like, wow, you know, we really need to touch on some of the things that are happening today. And an area that I feel like we're not as in touch with is, let's say, the DIY public lands crowd,
yep.
Right? So we deal with guided hunts every day, outfitters, guides, clients, people with money, people who are booking trips and travel, international travel, domestic travel, all of these things. Well, we have a different set of issues sometimes than the people who are DIY public ground or knocking on doors asking for permission. And some of our friends over at Eastman's Journal are the foremost experts in that area. They understand draws, public land accesses, research. They've got some great tools on their end. And so I'd reached out to Scott Reekers and asked him if we could get together and have him on the podcast, because he's a wealth of knowledge. He's a big member of their crew. And he's going to help us kind of understand it. Like, I've got a whole sheet of questions here for him. Mm-hmm. And we got some really cool topics we want to talk about today, you know, like tag percentages, technology, Boone and Crockett Club. That's going to be a hot topic today.
Some weather, drought.
Yeah, I'll get touch on some of these Western states that are going to have some issues this year. And, you know, I want to call him. I just want to get him on the phone right now, and let's get him brought into the podcast.
Let's do it.
All right, let's rock. Bring and roll, him up. Man.
So, Scott Reekers.
Scott Reekers. Let's do it.
Hey, Steve.
Scott, welcome to the Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you, sir?
Yeah, we're fantastic. I'm sitting here in the podcast booth with Travis Price from our office, and we just kind of started the podcast by talking about all the different things that, you know, we kind of specialize in at Steve's Outdoor Adventures. But there's this whole other world of, you know, I guess fans and customer base and, you know, and every, you know, followers and whatnot out there in that DIY public ground and, you know, and, you know, non-pay hunting type community and the tag draws and all this stuff. And I've always considered Eastman's Journal to be, and the whole Eastman's crew to be, you know, kind of the foremost experts in that area in America.
Well, I will certainly relay that compliment onto our entire team.
Please do. Please do. I mean, obviously I've known, you know, the Eastman boys for the better part of the last 20 years. We, you know, industry wise, you know, rub shoulders together from time to time. And like I said, if I ever had a question, you know, I knew where to go for my information. And
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, just, well, I mean, you go back to Mike, I mean, the Eastman's name, you know, Gordon Eastman. I mean, let's just step it back in time and go to black and white video, you know, that's on a reel. So it's generational Eastman knowledge. Mm-hmm.
So Scott, what maybe share what your role is at Eastman's.
So my role at Eastman's Hunting Journals, or Eastman's Publishing is probably the better way to put it, is for the better part of 8.5 years, digital media was my official title. And you know, but with the growth of digital media, we needed to decide what that actually meant. And so we did some rearranging the last little while, and I am officially in charge of podcasts, social media, and business development. So those are the hats that I wear. And it's a pretty cool job. I enjoy what I get to do. I enjoy getting to work in the podcast world. It is a growing media that is very exciting to be a part of. I love the fact that I get to work behind the scenes a lot of times with our podcast hosts, and I really get to celebrate their growth. I actually kind of revel in being the guy behind the scenes that helps other people do things and grow. So that's kind of a fun highlight, being able to say, yeah, I was a part of that. So That's really, I mean, and that's business development, you know, working to make things happen and grow relationships. Not necessarily always the sales side of business relationships, but the, you know, how can we partner together to grow things? And that's really my role. That's what I do a lot of here. And so I really thoroughly enjoy that.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. What is the, you know, I guess that with the team there, I mean, you guys have a much larger team than I do. I mean, how many people do you guys have in the building now?
We usually sit at about 15 people here in the office every single day. And you can double that with the number of people that I have that are third parties or, you know, like Brian Barney, he's technically not full time, but we could call him full time between all the work that he does for us because he hosts Eastman's Elevated, writes in the journals, is on TV, is on Beyond the Grid TV. You know, so he does a lot for us. He's right on the cusp. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, he's an employee. Oh yeah. He participates in our live events, division as well. So he does a lot of that. Jeff Nemnick, he's our podcast host for Eastman's Predator Pros. And so, you know, he's another one that does a lot for us during the Predator season, records a lot of podcasts. He's actually a great personality on a podcast too. So he's a lot of fun to listen to. And then, we've got a few more, more podcasts that are in the works. Some very, very unique things and exciting things that I'm going to be excited to share as soon as I can get them launched. I'm probably about 2 months out on them. But you know, we're fairly strategic with our launch times and things of that nature.
Gotcha.
And is everything that you do at Eastman's, basically virtual or digital, or is there an actual, I don't want to say storefront, but I guess you get what I'm getting at, the place to visit.
We, you know, we're based here in Northwest Wyoming, and you know, we don't have a place that's designed for like people to come in and see or a storefront. Cause the vast majority of what we do is media. So there's not really we don't have a lot of things where people could come in and buy, and, you know, the people do come in. There are a lot of locals who come in and renew their subscriptions to both of the print journals. But the way we've done that, and this has been kind of a fun journey. COVID really changed the live event scene, meaning that there were a lot of people who loved to go to these giant consumer shows before. But that was starting to kind of dwindle through the 2000s, and it was starting to change in the face of that. And people wanted education. They didn't necessarily want to go to a lot of these giant shows. There's still a few that are really good, like the Western Hunting Conservation Expo. That one's fun to go to. Dallas Safari Club was actually a pretty fun one to go to. But there aren't a whole lot of others that I just think on, like, man, I'm excited to go to, even, you know, even as somebody who's there, part of the quote unquote hunting industry. But we discovered that people are really craving and wanting to learn. So we have resurrected the old Gordon Eastman and Mike Eastman style events where people can come, and we're going to do live education and things of that nature to really help people, you know, learn about draw systems. We present about what Tag Hub does and will do, and then also help people see the long game that they have if they want to hunt out west, and all the things that they have going there. So that's been resurrected. We've actually got a big one coming up in Heber, Utah. It's the same week as the Total Archery Challenge, and we're going to go there, and we'll be at the Fieldcraft Survival Building, and it'll be fun. We did it there last year, had quite a few people come, and we're doing it again this year, but we upped it. We're planning on having a meal there so people can eat in between presentations. It'll run from 5 to 9. So I'm pretty excited. It's fun to get to do those sort of things. So that's the best equivalent I've got to a storefront. So
yeah, perfect.
Yeah. But talking about draws and playing long games, Wyoming just kind of had a change in their non-resident tag allocation. What are the details on it? I hadn't read all of that yet.
Well, so we're still in limbo. Nothing official has made it into the legislature yet. But what we've got going on is there's something called the Wyoming Wildlife Task Force. And this came about because there's a lot of concern about public land overuse. People were worried we were heading that direction. There's also a lot of concern about people being Wyoming residents their entire life and never drawing a premium elk tag or deer tag. And then there were, you know, there were also those other concerns about the quality of wildlife management. For instance, it's no secret that Wyoming's mule deer herds in Region G and H kind of taken it on the chin the last 20 years or so, and probably even before that. And they want, you know, a lot of residents are wanting answers for that. But the biggest one is a lot of the opportunity that's there. And so one of the things that kind of came about is the big five, the trophy species, and the one that most people really get, you know, kind of get excited about, I guess is probably the best one to look at is the sheep. Because that's, you know, it's such an iconic hunt that a lot of people are really vested in the system. And so Wyoming had been doing an 80-20 split before, where 80% of the licenses for those, you know, for those big five would go to residents, and then 20% will go to non-residents. Well, residents started doing a little bit of research, and they found out that all the states around us had much lower percentages that went to non-residents. And they started asking some questions like, what in the world is going on here? Why is our percentage so much higher than others? And in doing all of that, that research, that was one of the things that the Wyoming Wildlife Task Force said, okay, we will make a recommendation to the Wyoming legislature that this changes. And I'm being very, very simplistic in sure. this because well, there was a lot of conversation that went yeah, into it.
Keep it simple.
Yep. Keep it very simple. And what happened was the legislature passed that. And at the time, that's kind of, you know, everyone who had a vested interest in big game hunting in Wyoming has a seat at this table with the Wyoming Wildlife Task Force. Now, some people feel like one group or another is underrepresented or overrepresented, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the Outfitters and Guides Association, they said, okay, we'll give up the big five, that higher percentage, you know, cause that they also have a lot of residents that use them when they draw on these ridiculously hard once in a lifetime. That was also a change that happened. The big five became once in a lifetime. So there, once you draw a sheep tag in Wyoming, you're done. And I get that, you know, that makes sense to me. I don't understand why that wasn't done a lot of years ago. We would have cycled a lot more people through the system than have their opportunity. Cause I know some people who've put in for sheep tags, burn their points, and then they won it on the random tag, the 1 out of 10 that happened to be out there, mm-hmm. and they got a second sheep tag when there are people who've never drawn it. And so I understand why there's frustration about a system like that. And so it made sense for it to become once in a lifetime. It also made sense in my mind to get a little closer percentage-wise to what the other states had. I understand the residents' argument for those things. And so that happened, and the outfitters and guides were okay with that. You know, it's like, cause a lot of residents use them for sheep. So, the next thing that, it kind of happened is there was, you know, it was kind of like the feeling was that deer, elk, and antelope wasn't going to be something that changed this 90-10 model right now. It might in the future, but it was going to be a while. Well, not sure exactly what happened or what conversations happened in between, but the task force started tackling that issue. And they wanted to switch to 90-10. And, you know, bear in mind also, this task force has no legislative authority whatsoever.
They just recommend.
Yes, they're making recommendations. And then it still has to be debated. Well, because the task force so unanimously pushed for the big five changes, like, yes, some outfitters were behind, the public land guys were behind, everybody was behind. It made they said, okay, we better do this one. Well, deer, elk, and antelope is going to be a different story because there's a lot of mm-hmm. feelings on it. And so what's happened now is now there's conversation about switching to 90-10, but the conversation coming from the outfitters is they would really like to have an outfitter set aside for tags. And then that would be 5% of the non-resident tags is what they're looking for. Then there would also be 5% that that stay for the people who've been building preference points for quite a while. Now, this is going to be challenging.
Randy Newberg is blowing his mind at the moment because he hates the outfitter pools.
I don't hate them. I don't like, I'm honestly fairly neutral. What I want to see, is I want to see like really just laid out real clear for people. And this is the job of the task force to do this. You know, this is why I'm not
sure.
I'm not going to go do their job. Their job, if they really believe in this, like if they believe in this unanimously as a group and want to make this recommendation, what I want to see from them is I want to see an in-depth breakdown of the numbers. How many people in 2022 applied with an outfitter? How many didn't apply with an outfitter? Can you fit, if you were to turn this into 90-10, can you break that down and show me how this net effect is going to affect both people? Numbers are numbers. And you know, if you show exactly how many applied with an outfitter, and it's under 5%, well, guess what? There's not a big change there.
Yeah.
You know, and so those are the numbers that need to really be clearly displayed. And if done right, you can make your argument either way. And yeah. So yeah. That's what I want to see happen, because I'm not anti-outfitter. I 100% see that there are a lot of people that use them, and there's good reasons they use them.
Sure. You know,
someone who wants to go hunt in the high country of Wyoming, I like, if you've never done it, going on your first hunt as a backpack hunt is probably not the first time to go tackle the high
country. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Hello, Mr. Grizzly. Yeah,
or even with horses, right?
It's totally. I'll tell you what, we've actually got to grab a quick break, Scott, but I've actually got an additional breakdown on that for tag, you know, allocations and stuff that's worked in some other states. But like I said, we just got to take this quick commercial break. We got to hear from one of our sponsors. When we come back, I want to talk some more about these tags in the state of Wyoming.
Perfect.
This segment of the Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast is sponsored by Burris Optics. Find what matters.
All right. We're here in the podcast studio. Travis and I are chatting with Scott Reekers from Eastman's Journal, or Eastman's publications, and we're talking about Wyoming and the tag structure there, the distribution of tags, the 90-10, the 80-20, for the big five, the elk and the deer tags. You know, Scott, before we went to that commercial break, you know, you were talking about, like, you know, potentially doing like a 5% split for, you know, like 5% for outfitters and 5% for the general public. You know, there's another representation there outside of outfitters and the general public, and that's the landowners. Mm-hmm. Why hasn't Wyoming embraced a landowner tag system more traditional to, let's say, some of the other states, to reward landowners for being good stewards of the land, good wildlife managers, things of that nature?
That would be outside of the five and five.
Yeah. Outside of the five and five.
I mean, some of the not all outfitters are on private
land. Not all outfitters are on private land. Like you take like public lands. This is the other tough part that I've got. And correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, but in Wyoming, you can get you just go buy your general elk tag, right? You don't have to draw it.
That is correct.
And you can go get your region G or H deer tag. You buy just a statewide general deer tag, and you can hunt any of the general regions, right?
That is correct.
Okay. So there really isn't much of a draw for the general tags that involves a resident, non-resident split, right? Okay, so like we do a lot in regions K, C, Y, you know, these general, you know, units. I mean, I guess my question is do we need a split when it comes to those, when it's deer, elk, and antelope?
So here's – let's – I've got to get really into the weeds to really help understand this particular piece of the equation.
I just bought a Kubota, a mower deck for the back of my tractor. Okay. Get in the weeds.
Right. So take, here's what you do. Take a map of Wyoming.
Okay.
Split the bighorns in half.
Okay.
Then almost run a line straight down to the base of the Wind Rivers.
Okay.
And then run it over all the way like diagonal following the Continental Divide down towards Laramie.
Got it.
But stay on the, stay kind of with that line, stay a little bit. You kind of got that one, the Medicine Bow Forest, that area that there is a lot of public land.
Mm-hmm.
But split the state kind of like that. And once you do that, you'll understand that we have two very different management areas inside a single state.
Totally.
And because when you look at that, we'll call it the Northeast and then the Eastern section of the state, what you have is a very, very large section of public land or private land, excuse me.
Yes.
And then when you come over on the Western side, you have more public land than you know what to do with for the most part.
Yep.
Access issues generally aren't big. And on that side of the state, you've got things like Elk Area 100. You know, I don't like talking specific areas because I can screw up draw odds for people.
Oh, we're just throwing out a number. Stuff.
Yeah, but 100 is such a hard area to draw. I won't screw anything up. it's max point pool only. And so what happens in Area 100 is you've got a whole bunch of checkerboarded area. Well, there's a combination in that area of oil companies, and then there's still a little bit of railroad holdout. I'd have to go look at some of my Onyx or something to really take a look at that. But then there's also an area that's owned by a grazing association, but it's all that checkerboard stuff that happened with the railroad coming across Wyoming, where the railroad was awarded pieces of land in checkerboard fashion. Well, that area, the Rock Springs Grazing Association, they live and work in Sweetwater County. They send their kids to school in Sweetwater County, and it's a conglomeration of ranchers. If they cut that off, they would be pariahs in their community, because that has been open to the public for, as long as it's been able to be hunted. You're talking all that land around Green River, Wyoming, everywhere. I mean, it's just huge swaths of public land intermixed with private sections. They've just opened it up. And it's a good relationship. So the public's able to do that. But if you get across that line that I described earlier, where you get into a lot more ranching communities and it's higher risk for some of these ranchers that are there to just let somebody off the street come and hunt, it's a challenge, and it's not your neighbor that's coming to knock on your door anymore. There's a lot more non-residents. And so I've always looked at a trespass fee as kind of your skin in the game, so to speak.
Sure.
When you come as a non-resident and you're willing to pay a trespass fee, you're telling that landowner that I respect you enough to pay a trespass fee. That's how I've always looked at that. I've not always been able to afford that in my life. And it sometimes, I lived in Northeast Wyoming for a while, and it was frustrating. And it's tough to build relationships where a rancher will invite you at the tail end of the season to go kill an antelope, when you've gone to church with them for 5 years or whatever. it's frustrating because you also they're running a business too, especially if they lease it to an outfitter. I get it. You can't get mad at someone for wanting to run a business, but I've always looked at trespass fees as your ability to put some skin in the game and show the rancher that there's a transaction here, there's a relationship, and what you're offering me is valuable too.
Well, so just to take that one more step, Scott. So let's say you go out there and you have a good time with that lender. You've drawn a tag, you waited 10 years, let's say, to draw a tag for a tough elk hunt or a deer tag or whatever it might be. And you go out there and have a great time. It's a great hunt. And you really want to hunt with that landowner again. Mm-hmm. If you don't draw a tag the next year, he has to wait 10 years to earn your business. But yet for those 10 years, he's growing deer and elk and antelope. He's paying his property taxes. Once again, he's running a business. Why shouldn't a landowner have a landowner tag to then say, hey, Scott, I had a great time with you here last year. If you pay that trespass fee again, we're going to give you a landowner tag so that you can come back as often as you want to hunt this place. Why doesn't Wyoming have that?
Because the whole eastern half has the type 2 tags, which is a lot of them are private land only.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, when you look at like that whole section that I just described, that's majority private land, most of them are very easy deer draws. So that's why that hasn't happened over there. It's fairly easy to draw a deer tag in those regions.
Gotcha.
Now, so the argument for that is that we've already got that, and you've already got these type two antelope tags that there's leftovers every single year.
Yeah. I'm not so much talking about the eastern side. Let's look at Region K for a second. Like, obviously, we have a big operation we work with down in Region K. They've got, now that they've got all the leases, they've got something like 880,000 acres and multiple zones now, but they've leased up tremendous swaths of ground. But let's say just the Region K grounds, a couple 100,000 acres. Right now, that deer tag, that Region K deer tag, is a horrible draw. Like, they have to wait years to get a customer to come back. Elk tags, good Lord, the elk tags were over a 4-point draw this year for general non-resident in the special pool. And there is something wrong to me with a system where a private landowner and a business that has private land can't get a certain number of tags for their animal, like for the wildlife that they're raising, managing, spending money on habitat improvements and things of that nature. And I guess that's what my question is. It's not so much this eastern side and the type two tags and stuff. I'm familiar with those, but we're not seeing those tags in, let's say, the southwest region of the state, Region K, for example, where, once again, large tracts of private land, lots of wildlife, and deer tags, antelope tags. Good Lord, the antelope tag was, I didn't get it with like 5 or 6 points this year.
Some of that's like 9 now.
Yeah, I mean, we had guys with 3 elk tags or preference points not drawn the special pool this year. We had guys with 2 or 3 deer tags or points that didn't draw this year. They couldn't get the Region K tags. It's almost like Wyoming has taken the opportunity for landowners and outfitters and outfitting businesses to, you know, make a living. Whereas the other states, you know, we talk about like the 90-10 split's pretty common in a lot of the states that surround Colorado or the surround Wyoming. But those same states have, if we're going to look at those states for an example, they've got landowner tag programs, like Colorado, for example, nice landowner voucher program, Utah, got CWMUs and landowner tags. You know, there's a system in place for those private landowners that incentivizes them to be good stewards of the land because they're going to get to monetize that access to the wildlife that they're managing. I mean, what's Wyoming's position on that?
So with Wyoming, the issue you're going to run into with that is that it hasn't been done yet. And a little, if I understand my history correct, I'm sure some of the old timers in Wyoming will probably correct me on some of the details of this, because I'm pretty sure that I'm not alive, or I wasn't alive when these things happened. But one of the things that happened was there was a great compromise, meaning that we chose not to have transferable landowner tags en masse, because there are commissioner's tags in Wyoming that can be transferred. But those obviously are very expensive for the most part. But what happened was the wilderness rule for outfitters was an answer to that. And part of the reason for that was when these things happened, the majority of the outfitters were outfitting in Western Wyoming in the wilderness. And so the guide for wilderness hunts was a compromise for that, because what that did is it forced, and also Wyoming has so many migratory animals, and the hunting, when that system was made, that was the compromise. And so the whole crux behind the Wildlife Task Force is they're trying to address these exact questions that you're asking and wanting to work on, because we haven't changed a lot of those things in a very long time.
Bit outdated. I think, yeah.
Because things have obviously changed. The landscape has obviously changed. One thing I do think that will, the more I think about it, the more I like it, is the idea that they're going to manage general non-resident elk tags like by region. I do think that will help quite a bit. I do think that it will change that draw process quite a bit to help that system. Really, in all honesty, like, if we want to get down to like the absolute biggest issue that is facing just about everyone, outfitters, non-resident hunters, it's point creep.
I was just going to get into that.
Yes.
Because there's a whole trickle effect that's going to happen with the 90-10 or going from an 80-20 or a 75-25 to a 90-10, because that's about a 40 to 60 reduction in tags. But the preference point system, the way that everybody's laid out, is still the same, right? So if you look at sheep, what's going to happen to these people that have, that are, say, 50 years old, that have, say, 10 to 12 preference points for sheep?
Well, what about that 50-year-old guy with 19?
Yeah. Well, what I'm getting at is that, like, and I think the task force is proposing in 4 years that they go to a bonus point squared system.
Yep.
But what's going to happen to, say, anybody who's under 15 points or whatever, like, they may, are they just going to bow out and say, forget this? And then what, like, where's the future? The whole thing about preference points is a big topic to this, because it's going to shape who and how many people get tags and when.
Yeah. Cause, like, honestly, if this 90-10 thing happens, I was doing the math on this the other day. I'm sitting at 19 points and I should be at 20, but I'm at 19. After this year, I'll have 20. And if they go to 90-10, just doing the math on it, I'm just going to throw away my points. I'm going to walk away from it. It just, I won't catch up. Not before I'm too old to enjoy the hunt. And yeah, I mean, it's just, it's not going to be worth it. I'm going to have thrown away two decades.
And you're at 19. What about everybody else that's, you know, in the at teens 12 or 13, whatever?
Yeah, I get it. And so, you know, and I'm sure or Wyoming doesn't necessarily want to hear that, you know, like, oh God, there's going to be people throwing away their points. Partially because if you have 20 or more or 22 or more, you're like, oh, I'm within a few years, but there's 75, there's two tags in that zone, let's say, in that sheep area. You know, if there's two tags in that sheep area and you're with, between you and the top of the pool, there's 200 people. Oh man.
Yeah.
You just rode uphill out of your time zone, you know, or your lifespan. And so it's 80-20, I stay in the game because I feel like I at least maybe get the moose tag sometime before I'm 65. Yeah. But I would probably chuck it on the sheep.
Because it'll create, and especially for like elk and mule or just deer in general and antelope, if that happens, then it jumps up all those, because it goes to a 90-10, anyone that's 4-point draw for general elk license, if it doesn't switch to the different units, like you were saying, Scott, then all of a sudden that's going to turn into like maybe a 15-point draw instantly.
There would never be a 90-10 for general elk. There couldn't be, because residents don't drop tags out of the pool.
Right.
Yeah. But here's where I'm going with that though, Scott, is those private landowners, honestly, I don't think their clients, their customers, their visitors, their guests, I don't think they should have to draw a tag. I think that there should be an allocation of tags for private land only, just like, you know, Colorado has that code, the P code on the, you know, separate pool, you know, but give them a voucher, you know, say, okay, you've got X number of acres, here's X number of vouchers, you know, but incentivize them. Don't just fork them over. Say, hey, what'd you do for wildlife habitat? What did you do? What were your projects? What did you do, a thinning, a timber project? What was your habitat improvement? You know, and give these landowners that tag and access, because like this year, I know like the operation we work with down there, they're going to be at 50% capacity because they thought, well, we'll bet on 4 points and it was greater than four. They're less than half, like they have a handful of archery clients and they're a week and a half off on the rifle season. And it's just because they couldn't draw tags to hunt private land that they pay a fortune to lease. And the landowners are like, you know.
Because that doesn't really affect much the resident in any way, shape, or form. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that doesn't affect residents in any way, shape, or form. The only thing it affects is, like in that, you know, in that general elk pool is, you know, do they then reduce the number of tags in the general draw because they're given X number of tags to landowners? I don't know. Once again, it's a complex conversation, but other, you know, when we like started talking about this, Scott, you said, well, the people in Wyoming started looking at the other states and realizing that our 80-20 in Wyoming was a bit generous to non-residents. So they looked at the neighboring states and saw that they do 90-10. You know, if you're going to look at the other states for your 90-10 split, you probably ought to look at some of the neighboring states to see what landowner programs they've got or outfitter tag programs they've got that work for them. I don't know. That's just my thoughts, Scott. Obviously, we come from the outfitter guide side of things and the private lander side.
Tell.
Yeah, I mean, and I know that you work with that, like I said, the DIY public guys are, you know, the Eastman's, you know, lifeblood. So that's why I wanted to really dive into
also,
that with you.
Then there's also the resident. So it's trying to make a system that's fair for everybody.
Yeah.
Here's, I'm going to put my crystal ball on and I'm going, I've got friends that are outfitters. You guys know this. We've got several outfitted hunts that we work with.
Oh yeah.
I have a lot of do-it-yourself resident hunters that are really close friends. I've got a lot of friends who use outfitters on public land, and I've got a lot of friends who've used outfitters on private land. But number one, Wyoming is culturally also different than Colorado. And so the things that shaped like their Ranching for Wildlife program, the thing that shaped their voucher program and things like that, the cultural politics are very different here than the state of Colorado. They're very different than the state of Montana. And so what I will be very surprised, just based on those politics, not my preference or my, you know, recommendation, anything like that, but just I will be very surprised if we end up with transferable landowner tags. What I do see the public being much more okay with is figuring out how to expand the Type 2 license program. And what that would mean, it would mean a little more work for biologists because they're already doing the counts. So let's just use Region K as an example. You could create a Type 2 draw for Region K that, you know, obviously the outfitters are going to put a lot of their clients in for, and you're much more likely to get them into those, because if it's private land only hunt and there's X amount that are allowed, it allows the outfitter plan year by year. And then it also allows people to draw, and then you don't necessarily have, you don't necessarily have to deal with the same. There are a lot of people in Wyoming who just don't like those transferable landowner tags for a variety of reasons. I'm not against them. But I'm just, it's the politics of the state. So putting my crystal ball on, I would say one of the great compromises that could come out of the task force, and I have no insider information, just to be, you know, just to be really transparent on that. I don't have anyone whispering in my ear that that's what's going to happen. Here at Eastman's, we've taken we're going to report what's happening because in order to be able to report what's happening and do it well, we have to represent a lot of sides, the DIY being one of them, non-resident DIY being one, the resident DIY being another, because we live here. And so all that said, I could see a Type 2 expanded system coming into play, and I could see a lot of residents being okay with that. Like, yeah, you know what? My rancher who wants to hunt his land and wants to be able to let his kids, you know, his kids go to school with mine. Yeah, I could see a Type 2 license being available, but then they can't get a general tag.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a little bit of compromise in there, and I think that's possible. But you know, we'll see. I know it has to some degree worked in like northeast portion of the state. And I think you could model it for some other areas, but you'd really have to there'd be a lot of research. The Game and Fish Commission would really have to understand its ins and outs. And then that's just hearing what I've heard from a lot of the residents here is that their appetite for transferable landowner tags isn't really there. And part of the biggest reason for that is Wyoming's migration, especially on the western half of the state, our migratory herds are a big portion of that. And so Region K, you know, very obviously where you guys are very, very familiar with, the migrations there aren't nearly as strong as what they are like in Region G and H, or even in this Yellowstone country into you know, Teton and Park County for elk, you know, and the mule deer out into the Red Desert. And so I think that biologically plays into a lot of that mentality. And so my gut says is that a lot of the residents of Wyoming would be open to listening to Type 2 private land only tags. And maybe even on some of these limited quota areas, they'd be open to a private land only type tag, maybe splitting some of those. And then you might also have, you know, it might be a win for residents in that if the landowner can only let his outfitter use the private land that he's got with these type two tags, well, he might have a little, little more reason to let, you know, to put some of his, some of that land that's just a little strip of land that accesses some BLM. He might just let them, let that go into the hunter management walk-in area. So there might be some benefit where it just connects two sets of public land, you know, 100 yards separates it. Can't really hunt that with your outfitter. So there might be some compromise there. There might be some wiggle room. I could see that getting a lot of discussion.
Sure.
But the transferable tags, just the residents don't like that system for a variety of reasons.
Gotcha.
This segment of the Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast is sponsored by Bergara Rifles, where the people truly make the difference.
We're back here in the podcast studio. We're at the table we call Clark.
Yes, we are.
Travis Price and I are chatting with Scott Reekers from Eastman's Publications. And we've talked a lot about draws and the kind of the 90-10 split. And of course, that's a deep subject,
yeah,
you know,
it is.
Landowner tags, type twos.
Weeds.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I think everybody who started to look at hunting out west has realized is that you better figure out draw odds. You better figure out how to get your hand on tags. There's places like in Colorado where you can buy an over-the-counter elk tag, you know, second and third seasons, or relatively easy tags to draw. And then there's hard tags to draw. Sometimes you can accumulate preference points and with a second or third choice, draw, you know, a reasonable tag so you can get in the woods every year and come in the field. And, you know, Eastman's Tag Hub's always been something that I've leaned on. Scott, can you tell us what is Eastman's Tag Hub? And what, how can our listeners and followers kind of, you know, find it, subscribe to it, and of course, benefit, utilize it? Yeah.
Absolutely. So Eastman's Tag Hub can be found at taghub.eastmans.com. And if you are familiar with Eastman's Hunting Journals, if you've ever subscribed over, you know, our 35 years of putting that publication out since 1987, you can see that there's been hunt research done. And Mike, when he first started that, he started doing these tips on how to get out west and how to hunt and how to actually go and experience that and go get that buck or bull that you've always wanted. So he started that, and then it evolved, and then it turned into the members research supplement, and then it changed the members research section. And we started breaking down some of the better hunts in the west. And this is long before my time here, but they started breaking them down and putting the odds in there and how many points you would need. And then a lot of people don't know this, but Guy Eastman, Mike's son, been the host of Eastman's Hunting TV for years. He's actually got an engineering degree from Purdue, went there full ride scholarship.
Nice.
So he's smart, I guess is the best way to put it. You don't want to get numbers wrong around him because he like, no, that's not right. This is what it is. You know, he can quote stats. We've actually had people come up to us at shows or industry people be like, all right, who's the Rain Man who puts the MRS together? And eventually that evolved and turned into a breakdown of all 11 Western states inside the magazines. Well, the problem with magazines is you're limited on space. You know, you can put out a 110 page magazine and still maybe only get like 35% of the units in any state on any species. Like, for instance, I write the MRS for the great state of Nevada. Well, the problem you've got is that I literally would do all these deer hunts, all these antelope hunts, put all the data together, run them through all our proprietary algorithms, figure out where they stand. And I'd have to cut and paste the top third just to make it fit in the magazine. And so there were a whole bunch of pieces that we just weren't getting to share. And some of them were good hunts, but I had to make a judgment call on where do I cut this off? Where do I put these? What do I do with them? And so what I did is sat down with Ike and Guy, and they said, hey, we want to put this in digital sortable form. I said, all right, figure out how. And we found a system where we were able to take all that information from the MRS with every antlered hunt across all 11 Western states, and we were able to put them into a digital sortable form so you could find what you're looking for. And you can sort it inside Tag Hub hundreds of ways. And we've got, including all of our weather analysis that we have in there, we have about 600,000 to 700,000 data points that you can look up and look at. And we update drought conditions every quarter. So you can look and you can see how the weather has been going and things of that nature. And it's very, very informative. We rank all the units by blue, green, or yellow. And what that means is a blue chip is the best unit, but that also means you're gonna have to bring a boatload of points to make it happen. You know, that's how it works. If, you know, for the most part, if you're looking at blue chip hunts in Wyoming for mule deer, you better be in the max point pool. And even at the max point pool, there's probably more people in max point pool applying for the five, you know, non-resident deer tags that are available in that hunt than there are actually tags available. You probably got 10 people with max points applying for those five tags. So that in and of itself is an explanation on point creep, why people with max points don't draw. And so then you've got your green chip units, and some of those you may have to have max points for, but not all of them. And you can go have a great hunt. You can have a lot of fun in a green chip, but you're just going to have to work harder to say if it's an elk, you're going to have to work harder to find that top notch bull. And then you've got a lot of your yellow, which that means we call it marginal. And that can be marginal for a variety of reasons. One of the biggest reasons an area is a blue chip is public access. We put how much public access there is in an area on there. We give you a percentage. And when you partner with your mapping applications, it's a very effective tool to be able to do your research and look and see what is there. And so, you know, some of these yellow hunts, like how I talked about, you know, earlier in the podcast, Northeast Wyoming, where it's kind of a challenge to find public access. So those probably are going to be marginal because we put it in, you know, that algorithm on an overall. And for the most part, it's for the DIY guy. Well, when you look at that, guess what? That may be the reason it's there. Trophy quality may be high, but it's hard for the do-it-yourself guy. But a guy who wants to use an outfitter and sees that trophy quality is high, but access is low, knows, huh, that outfitter that I'm working with wasn't lying about the quality range here in his unit. So there's more than one way to use this thing as a tool, but that's why we would call something marginal. So, and that's how that whole system has evolved. And we built that so it's sortable. But with Tag Hub, we also put in a section called expert analysis. And I, you know, I'm borderline fanboying here a little bit, but when I write my Nevada, I always measure it against what did guys Wyoming elk look like? Because Wyoming elk has always been kind of our crown jewel in the MRS with guys analysis. And we always shoot and strive for that level of, you know, expertise and understanding what we're recommending and where we're sending our hunters and those units that we're recommending. So, you know, when we set up that expert analysis section, we do our write-ups to measure it against that and do a really good job of making sure we explain the draw process. Why, you know, I'll pick out in each of my species, I'll pick out the top 10 units that I would recommend people with max point pools be chasing inside the state of Nevada. Now, granted, Nevada is an interesting, it's a weighted, like we discussed, it's a weighted bonus point system. And so, you know, it's your number of points squared plus one is the number of applications you have in. And then it's the, whichever one has the lowest number signed by the system is the one that's going to get looked at, but they're going to look at your whole application first. I've said that a lot in case you haven't.
I picked up on that. Yeah. You rattled that one right off.
And you have to learn it and you have to know it inside and out. And it's fairly important to understand all of those pieces of the equation. And so that's what Eastman's Tag Hub is. It's taking all that knowledge that, you know, in the years that I've been writing Nevada, taking all that, making it digital, sortable, and then giving you that expert analysis. It's also access to our team here to call us to find out, hey, I've got this many points in Colorado, and I want to go kill such and such mule deer. How do I go about doing that? And then we'll talk with you about it. I've actually got a, you know, we did a transition this year with a couple of our data people. So now I've actually got someone who is spending about three quarters of her time acquiring all the data from the states and getting it into the form, so all of our authors can actually spend their 4,000 man hours a year to just go through all this data and make sure their analysis is correct. And we're really pretty proud of that data set, but TagHub's even more than that. You've got access to all the digital journals, you know, years back. Then you've got access to Mike's entire book collection with an elite membership. You also have access to episodes of Eastman's Hunting TV before they come out. You've got access to Beyond the Grid TV, our digital series that goes up on YouTube. We posted there a month to a month and a half beforehand. So it's content, content, content.
Yeah. And you also give away free hunts, do you not?
We give away six a year.
Six a year. And that's through TagHub, is it?
Four of them are specifically for TagHub members. And then two, you get a print journal with my membership to TagHub. And so we've given away an elk hunt in Southern Colorado for years and a mule deer hunt in Montana for years. And those are also included.
Cool.
Awesome. You know, you talked about technology and like the mapping apps, using it with TagHub. Mm-hmm. And obviously TagHub is something that, like I said, I use it and we're, you know, it's something that is a wealth of knowledge for anybody who's going to hunt the Western states.
Yes.
But you and I have talked about technology with regards to rifle scopes, trail cameras, things of that nature. We've had these conversations, but you know, with today's technology and let's say apps like Onyx and Farwide and Basemap or some of these others that have come out, you know, where your smartphone, your iPhone or your Android phone can become a GPS, open up a map, show you where you're standing. Are you on a boundary? Are you on the edge of a unit? Are you in the middle of a unit? What unit are you in? What private landowner is on the other side of that fence? I mean, the amount of information and knowledge that we have in the palm of our hands these days is incredible. And I think that people are crazy not to take advantage of that. And like you were saying, you know, have your TagHub information there and get in the field, up, you know, pop open your phone, hit, pop open an app, you know, bring in all of this information and, you know, it, and you can legitimately save yourself, you know, weeks or months of frustration by doing research, just using an iPhone, you know,
or legalities, quite frankly.
Yeah, on legalities, you know, getting caught trespassing, getting caught hunting in the wrong unit or anything like that. You know, let's slide toward technology just for a second. I mean, obviously, like I said, we talked about TagHub, but what's the Eastman's Journal position, or do they have a position on the use of trail cameras in hunting?
So it's where I'll give you where I personally stand on trail cameras. I don't have an issue using trail cameras. What does concern me is when they stay there in season. I don't have an issue with using them for scouting, but what seems to take fair chase out in my mind is when you have access to that camera in season, and then what happens is somebody can go there like, oh, that buck was here at this time yesterday.
Oh, well, let's take that one step further. There's cell phone service almost everywhere. Yes. Cellular trail cameras, you can act. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's there right now. Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, literally he's there right now. Let's head up there. Yep. And, you know, and of course I was going to talk more about Boone and Crockett Club as we went on here, but you know, Boone and Crockett Club had language at one time that said that if you ever captured an image of an animal on camera and you ever killed it at any point in time in its life, that was an ineligible entry because you used technology to locate. Now they've changed that, of course, because I mean, you could get a picture of a fawn and if it had an identifiable spot on it and you killed it as a record book animal later, it wasn't eligible. That was a bit excessive. Now it's immediate actionable, I think is the words you're using, or something similar to that, where with a cellular trail camera, if you take immediate action,
upon you're no longer that you're
like if my phone pinged right now and I was like, oh, look at that great big bull up there, I'm gonna go up and kill him. I went up and killed him. That is not in the spirit of free range and fair chase or anything like that. You know, it's so I'm with you on that. I will say this. I don't mind cameras being out during hunting season as long as people aren't taking immediate action on the animals. You know, if you're checking it and you're like, oh, I'll be doggone, that buck is still hanging around here, you know.
Well, the challenge with that is it's so tempting to do that even if,
Of course
it is. And how do you,
I guess I'm thinking about on your honor system, right? Yeah. You know, it's like golf, you know, so.
Yeah.
Which never works.
Yeah.
No, nice try though, Steve.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. All the other guys will go to live golf and
Your score keeps going down and down.
Yeah, exactly. I get it. And so I follow you on that. I don't have a problem with them having to be pulled during the season. I will tell you what I use them for more than anything else during the season is trespassing. I love it when I get a picture of a trespasser packing a rifle or a bow, you know, on private ground, and I've got an immediate, then I can take immediate action and not use fair chase to catch them.
I don't mind using it just for predation purposes too, to see what's going on there. That's kind of a big thing, even during season.
But if I have a camera up and it's on a spot, you know, I mean, I'm not just getting, you know, trespassing, I'm getting animal pictures, right? I mean, I use them for security more than anything else, but
The way I look at it with a lot of that is that, you know, there are areas where the gray line or the gray area just isn't worth it. I like to stay away from gray areas. And it's not that I'm a black and such a black and white rigid person. It's that there are certain things in life to me that just aren't worth, worth having my ethics questioned.
Of course.
And because we sit in this public sphere, if I have cameras up anywhere, especially if they can transmit during the season with all this cell operation, that could get me in trouble ethically. We've done reviews on these trail cams that can connect to your cell phone, and we've, you know, and as long as you follow the rules of the states, you know, I don't have an issue personally. For my own personal ethics, like, I would pull them before season just because those are things I believe in.
Yeah.
I really personally, like with white-tail deer and things like that, I understand why a lot of people use them, because that's one of the only ways you're going to find out, really get counts on how many deer you actually have on your property.
Yeah.
Because, you know, those things are, you know, they can hide under logs. It feels like a little bug, and then all of a sudden show up and you've never seen them.
Sure.
So I get why that has been developed, and it's a management tool in a lot of the Midwest, but on public land, it's something that can definitely be manipulated a lot.
Oh yeah.
And I just don't want to even get close to that gray area. So I'm not saying I would never use a trail cam, but what I would do is I would make sure it's long gone before any legal season was open, because to me, that's just staying away from that gray area. And I don't ever want to be, you know, like Steve, you know, you and I've had a couple email conversations where, you know, or I think it was a phone conversation the other day. I want to have a seat at the table when it comes to conversations about ethics.
Yep.
And to do that, you have to walk the walk.
Yeah.
Walk the walk. I had a, you know, I was a
your name's got to be clean.
I was a youth pastor for a long time. And, you know, one of the pastors I listened to, he called it taking the high road. Whenever you talked about behavior and ethics, if you always take the high road with these things and the way that you handle them, you're never going to be in a position where you regret the decisions that you made from that sense. So if you always take the high road, you're good. And then that puts you in a position to be an authority on those things and have real conversations. And so to me, that's what's worth it.
Yeah. It's called credibility. So once again, we need to take one more short commercial break. When we come back, I'm going to talk about this technology. We're going to take it one step further. There's a bigger story at play here. And we'll see where it goes, because I think there's another level of technology that is acceptable to hunting. And like I said, we'll talk about it when we come back from this short commercial break.
This segment of the Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast is sponsored by Marathon Seat Covers. We've got you covered.
All right, we're back here in the podcast studio chatting with Scott Reekers from Eastman's Publications. And we've talked about a lot of things, Wyoming Draw, Eastman's Tag Hub, and then we started talking about technology. And we just talked about trail cameras and, you know, should they be used? You know, how should they be used during the season, out of the season? Or, you know, last year, I kind of really got thrust into the technology discussion at a time when I wasn't even really thinking about it. And, you know, Scott, I talked to you about it because I called you because I knew you guys were sponsored by SIG, you know, and and we're sponsored by Burris. And I went on a hunt in Alaska with the Eliminator scope and shot an exceptional caribou. Took it to my good friend Buck Buckner to be scored. Sure enough, the numbers are adding up pretty fast. I mean, we were touch and go there to maybe break that 477 number. And, you know, came up just a hair short, but still good enough to be one of the greatest ever killed. But when I was filling out my affidavit for the Boone and Crockett Club, it specifically asked a question about the scope. And if I answered it honestly, the caribou would not be eligible for the record book. And I had not noticed this language before. And they said it's been there all along. I need to go back and look. But all the other animals I've entered into the record books, in the Boone and Crockett book, I after hunting them with an Eliminator scope, I didn't realize this was one thing. So, you know, basically if I took an animal with the Burris Eliminator laser scope, the fact that there was a laser rangefinder built into the scope made any trophy that I took
ineligible
for the book. And I started thinking about that. I thought, well, what about the guys who are using, let's say, the SIG system, you know, where you're ranging with a handheld rangefinder that communicates with your phone that then talks to the scope and it gives you the same, you know, similar things, just more steps. Or the Swarovski, you know, or Bushnell at one time had a laser rangefinding rifle scope. Didn't have automatic bolt drop compensation, but still there's a few models out there. And I was informed by the Boone and Crockett Club, no, not one of those animals is eligible for entry. And it really made me think. I thought, wow, you know, I didn't realize this, you know. You know, Scott, when I called you, you're like, nah, the SIG system's eligible. I was like, yeah, I'm not reading it that way. And then, you know, through all of our discussions, we realized, wow, this is really the case. But Buck Buckner did something really cool for me. And he gave me my score sheet signed and certified, like it's certified. And he said, someday when the rules change, if they change, you now have your sheet and you can enter this animal. You know, and I had a guy at the Boone and Crockett Club tell me, he said, hey, remember this, at the turn of the century, semi-automatic and pump action rifles, you know, as they came out.
Lots has changed.
Yeah, Boone and Crockett Club didn't allow animals to be entered in the book if they were shot with a pump action rifle because they thought that those pump action guns were going to be the end of animals, that they're going to wipe out herds of animals. They weren't going to be good for wildlife. Now, obviously, we know that not to be true, and that the pump action and semi-automatic rifles can be used to legally kill an animal that goes in the record book. And basically the message I was getting is time's going to change. The Rules and Ethics Committee will meet, you know, I called it on myself. I didn't try to hide it. I didn't show submit a photo of me with the caribou and no rifle in the shot. You know, I just called it and said, hey, I did it. You know, I mean, I shot it on national television. How can you hide that? You know, first and foremost, but before it ever aired on television, I was saying, hey, I don't think this animal is eligible right now.
Yeah.
What have you guys heard? I mean, once again, you're sponsored by SIG. Have you guys had a conversation with SIG about that?
You know, I know Brandon, when the SIG BDX system came out, he had a lot of conversations with the guys at SIG about that. And in all honesty, our first point of discussion was really looking at, okay, is this legal in the state of Wyoming? And so we called a few wardens, you know, multiple wardens on purpose, because in the field, the warden is the one going to be making the judgment call.
Of course.
Some of them said, hey, I'll get back to you. Some of them said, no issue whatsoever. And based on the way that the law reads here in Wyoming, the BDX system is not illegal. And so for me, here's where the BDX is a little bit different, because the BDX, the rifle scope itself, it has the electronics in it. There's no two ways about that. However, it is not projecting itself. It still requires, in order to make it work, or the dot to show up, if you will, inside the scope, it requires someone to actually run the BDX range finder. And in so doing, there's still a gap. We actually timed this. I don't use the BDX personally because I'm just so comfortable with the turret, Steve. Sure. That's just why I don't. I've gotten comfortable. I like my Ford Off app and I'm good with it. So 38 years old, been doing this a while now. I know my personal limits as far as range go. I am comfortable with that. I'm not going to push those. And I've killed a lot of big animals on public land with it, mule deer in particular. And so with that in mind, like for me, the BDX wasn't the system that I was going to use, but I knew there were other people who would, and they would enjoy that. And it'd be something that I trust. But for me, there's also another piece of this equation. I tend to hunt in colder weather too. And so with that in mind, I look at it like batteries can fail a lot. So being able to dial up, that helps. Or I'm set at 200 yards most of the time. And so getting in close, if I need to, I will.
Sure.
That's not going to fail me. So bear all this in mind for me personally. When I look at the technology that the SIG BDX has, I have no issue with it being used in the field. If someone were to not have an entry put into Boone and Crockett because they use that SIG BDX, well, I would hope that eventually time will change, because we timed it. Like we timed it sitting there at the range. Like for me to range and dial, it took the exact same amount of time for someone to actually like look at it, get the range and do it. We tested that. But the difference is that SIG BDX system, that light there actually is a good thing, because I'm thinking about my little girls, that when I teach them how to shoot, having that little light in there, that's going to be an effective tool for helping them see what they're looking at and pointing at.
Yeah.
Hold it 6 inches over its back. That helps me make a better ethical clean shot.
Of course.
When, so for me, there's an argument that there are going to be things that come as a result of technology that are an ethical plus. For instance, one of the things that's happening now is that different optic companies are now working with these same mapping companies that we were discussing, and they're able to throw a range, throw a pin downrange. And, this has been great technology for me to have and be able to see right when I open up my app, my mapping app, and there'd be a pin of where I put the range for this mule deer a couple years ago, because I shot it, but he rolled downhill.
Mm-hmm.
And so knowing where I hit him and then seeing the path of trees that he took out, and not hoping I just happened to run into that path, that would have saved me probably 20 minutes. And then in 20 minutes of hiking in the dark back to camp, so
you'd have walked to a pin.
Yes. I'd have walked to a pin to get my, get my blood trail started. And I think of, when you haven't hunted very long, if you've never lost an animal or been a part of a hunt where an animal got wounded or lost. And, I can think of a couple of those situations where I've had friends who, if they'd have been able to drop a pin on where they shot that animal from the point where they shot, we might have been able to blood trail a little quicker, and that might have led to a recovery.
Yeah. Well, especially if you're shooting 600-700 yards across a canyon, you're hiking for a long time. You're losing sight of that point. Now it's like, God, was that big broken top aspen over there that the mm-hmm. deer was standing? Oh crap. There's another one over there.
Yeah.
Which one was it? Was it that yellow rock over there? Yeah. No, I follow you all the way. And so there's some technology, like you said, that would help with the ethics and efficiency. And I get it. I think that obviously as time goes by, it's going to be more acceptable because, the word was brought up, like the old guard, right? The old guys that run Boone and Crockett. Yeah. Remember this, for decades, when they came in to Boone and Crockett, use Buck Buckner, for example, when he joined the Boone and Crockett Club and took a prominent role with them, he was entrusted with preserving the integrity of what I consider to be North America's most prized conservation organization. I mean, without a doubt, I respect that organization more than all the others combined. Mm-hmm. And this old guard when that torch was passed to them, the responsibility of preserving that integrity was passed to them, and they took it seriously, as well they should have. And they shouldn't just say, oh, that'll, I mean, if they want to call it the Steve West rule, they can, but that Steve West used that eliminator to kill another big critter. You know, they're not just going to say, well, let's let him in the book, or no, we can't. They have, they have really deep conversations like we are right now about, wow, what's going on? What's the change today? Should we allow this? Should we not allow this? These are people that take their position seriously. Mm-hmm. And I respect them for that. And that's why I didn't take it personally. I mean, at first I was like, oh, those SOBs, you know, doggone it.
But for me, like, I understand the traditional side of it. There's a lot that still has to go right, as we all know, to be able to harvest any animal, let alone a record book animal. You have to be in the right place at the right time.
Oh, yeah.
You have to stalk the animal correctly.
You got to have some 20-year-olds that drag your ass up a mountainside way about 4 miles past your limit.
Exactly. Yeah. So, like, for me, even though... And you mentioned time, Scott, that, you know, that for me on the eliminator is the kind of the big difference where you don't have to get out of the scope and range and get back in. Other than that, and I've used that scope multiple times, I don't see a huge difference in whether you should be able to put in a record book or not on that. That's just my opinion.
Well, you think about this. So I've got the muzzleloader world record woodland caribou. I shot it at 10 feet with a muzzleloader.
It didn't matter what you had. You
had an eliminator.
Probably didn't even hit the, obviously didn't even hit the dot.
I could have bayoneted him. Yeah. Yeah. No, I didn't even look through the scope, you know, but I couldn't enter that animal because that scope was on the gun.
Yeah.
The caribou last year was only 322 yards. It wasn't even that far of a shot.
Yeah.
Did I use it? Yeah. I ranged it. You know, I was like, oh God, he's not that far away. Wasn't a difference maker. You know, to date, none of the book animals I've killed were so far away that it was a difference maker, but the scope was on the gun. It could have been. I've probably taken, I know I've taken more animals with an eliminator than any other human being. I mean, just being a part of it from day one. Probably shot more rifles with an eliminator on other than maybe a handful of Burris employees. I'm going to be the first to say it does make a difference to not have to get out of the scope when you're familiar with the rifle. Yeah, it's that time. Yep. Well, not only that, it's target acquisition. Time aside, you're watching an animal. Let's say you got a 6-point bull and he's in the timber and he's walking down a ridge in and out of the timber, mixing in and out of the cows. Things are happening, right? You're ranging him without ever taking the crosshairs off of him. You're not, because if you put the scope down, now this happened on that coos deer hunt year before last. I don't know if you remember this. Mm-hmm. I spotted a giant coos deer buck. I got hit. When I got to camp, Adam Summers didn't have a rifle. All right. Yeah, Adam, I'm calling you out. And I loaned him my rifle that had the eliminator on it, and I kept my backup gun for myself that had just a regular turret top veracity scope on it. Love that. Shoots good. Same thing, Scott. I'm real familiar with how to run a turret system. Second nature to me, right? I get this big buck in the scope. I mean, I've got him. All I need is the range. I'm hollering at my guide, Armando, what's the range? What's the range? He can't find the deer. This deer's 400 or 500 yards away on a cactus covered hillside. He's just walking across it. I've got him pasted. But when you get out of the scope, that buck disappears because you can't see him. Have you hunted coos deer yet, Scott?
I have not.
They're called the coos deer, the gray ghost for a reason. They become a ghost. Okay. And when this deer, so I had to grab my rangefinder, I put it up and I realized I have no idea where this thing is, but I know approximately where. I just ranged the hillside. Got a close enough range that I knew I would smoke him, turn the turret, go back in the scope, and I could not find that deer to save my life. I lost my target, and I could not reacquire it because of the surroundings and the animal itself. He was in the camera the whole time. The camera guy didn't even realize it. He disappeared in the camera, but he was in frame the whole time. I couldn't get back on. If I'm using the eliminator laser scope, that buck is dead. He's in the cooker today. And he's there because I got the crosshairs on him. I would have ranged him. I would have stayed on him. When Raymond said, yeah, I'm on him, that had been like, all right, I'm just going to wait for him to stop and I'm going to dust him. I didn't need anybody else to range him. I didn't have to get out of the scope to range him. I didn't have to turn a turret. I didn't have to do anything. So the scope itself does make a difference. It's a selling feature for the scope. That's why people use it.
Yeah.
And I don't think people should not use the scope or not buy the scope because they're worried about not getting in the record book. The animal will stand on its own merit. And someday it'll probably be allowed into the record book when times change. It doesn't take anything away from the animal. And honestly, yeah. I don't see a reason why it should be illegal, but because I find a way to, you know, it makes me a more ethical hunter. I'm not guessing my holdover.
And the reality is it's all about the experience anyhow. Oh, yeah. And yeah, whether it goes in a record book or not.
Yeah. So, yeah. Tell you what, we're rolling up on a time limit here for this segment of the show. And I really wanted to talk a little bit more about that. And then kind of touch on, drought conditions before we end the podcast. But I've got to hear from one more sponsor. Like I said, okay. when we come right back from this short break, I got to talk about the drought conditions across the West. Hold on 1 second.
Absolutely. Right,
this segment of the Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast is sponsored by Pendleton Ammunition. Hand loaded, one round at a time.
All right. As we wrap up this podcast today, you know,
lots of really good topics.
Oh, we've had great topics. Right. I mean, Scott, your wealth of knowledge, especially in the technology and the draws in the state of Wyoming and or just the Western states in general. And I want to thank you again for coming on the program.
Absolutely. Anytime, Steve.
So, you know, one of the things that we deal with every day is we're advising hunters. Travis and I are hunting consultants, and we're talking to people about drought conditions and fire and where you should hunt or not hunt, you know, this upcoming year. And, you know, drought is just something that's happening. I mean, it's a reality. And I mean, this year, like where I'm sitting right now, Scott, I've got grass that's green 3 feet deep up on the mountain. The elk have so much feed. They're laying on their sides and just rotating their bodies and mowing down grass. It's ridiculous. The bulls are going to be massive. This is our big antler growth year. And it's been probably 18 years since I've had a year like this. I think 2004 was the last time. What are you seeing across the West? What are the dry spots and which ones are the green spots?
Unfortunately for all the people that had floods in Montana, their areas are going to be excellent growth years. You know, we're not far from where Red Lodge had the flooding. And so I really feel for those people. On the flip side of the coin, hopefully they're, you know, able to get their community sorted out and back to a better condition before this fall, before hunting season. Maybe they can collect on some of that that money that comes in from out-of-state hunters or just even in-state hunters who stop at their gas stations and things like that, and or even stay at Airbnbs. I hope they're able to get things rock and rolling again in those parts. But obviously the flooded areas, that there was a lot of precipitation there. So this is Yellowstone country. Anywhere in direct relationship with Yellowstone is probably going to have solid antler growth. Region G and H should be good. They should for sure start well. The one thing that can happen is August can get pretty pretty hot, and so, you know, you can see in years like this where it starts out really well and then it gets hot. So if you have a G or an H tag, be mindful of that and adjust your expectations. If August gets ridiculous hot and you're not finding top end development like what you would expect there, that may be why, just because it got hot. And, you know, the age class of the bucks there in particular, you know, in 17-18, we lost the winter of 17-18. We lost a lot of deer just because of how cold it was and how much snow we got. And so now we're finally getting to where the bucks that should be getting into maturity are growing, but some of them don't know how to grow yet, meaning that they don't know that you follow the green wave up and down. So sometimes those younger bucks that are just starting to put on their first or second good set of headgear don't know that you need to come down to follow that green wave in August. And so, you know, just be patient with your scouting if you have that tag, and make sure you spend enough time up there to know. Also, trust your guide on what is the top end if you're going with an outfitter, because they were up there scouting and they were looking for that buck for you. But sometimes if August gets really hot, there's that top end development. I know Colorado is probably going to be a mixed bag, you know, as far as that goes. It's kind of got an inverse relationship. Last year, the wet was, you know, was south of us, you know, so Montana and Wyoming and Idaho were really dry, but there's kind of an inverse relationship. So the south of us was fairly wet. For instance, in southern Colorado, Ike and Guy went down and they had their hunt with our EBJ hunt winter. And you know, there was, it's a migratory hunt as things dry up where they were at, and they had a lot fewer elk to look at because it has been so wet down there that the elk hadn't had to move yet. They moved later, you know, later in the season, that sort of thing. But at that moment, it just hadn't happened, you know. So when hunting season came around, so it was a little bit different year hunting there, but that's just, you know, that's normal. It's drought conditions. But the antelope, on the other hand, you know, they had had good wet conditions the whole time. And so therefore, you know, antelope actually do a lot more of their growing really earlier in the spring. Mm-hmm. And that, having that wet and that, you know, that growth out there, that was good for them. This year, we'll see if that inverse continues as far as us being really wet up here and then it being drier further south. We'll see how that kind of plays out over the course of time, but definitely something to pay attention to. If you don't watch the drought monitors, I'd highly encourage it. We also update that every quarter inside Tag Hub. So we'll have another update before hunting season comes, so you can see, you know, see that and manage your expectations as well. Personally, I think that you can affect antler growth up to 20% depending on how severe drought is. And then the other piece of the equation is, if you're hunting in a drought area, or if you know that you're hunting in a drought area, just expect to find bulls in particular, bull elk in particular, with broken tines. That's just going to happen.
Sure.
You know, if you don't manage for that expectation, I think, man, you know, 350 or bust and completely intact, you know, just accept the fact that, you know what, it broke its second and third off. Man, I got a bruiser, and that thing's going to look cool on the wall. Because a 350 bull is still a big bull no matter what.
Yeah.
It's a huge bull. You know? Heck yeah.
And the problem with drought conditions, just to kind of like talk about why we're talking about this, is that, you know, when you have a reduction of feed and water, it really impacts the overall population from a breeding standpoint, or from reproduction, from higher mortality rates. And then I was also reading that, and I never really thought about this until I saw it, is that predation actually has a large impact at that point too, because of cover or lack of. It's just something I never really thought of. But when you couple all of that together, and then it starts to impact the populations, and that rolls over to the following year. So it's really, when I looked at it in March, there was most of all of the Western states was in drought, but now it seems like there's some pockets that, like around here, that are kind of bouncing back with some spring rains and stuff, which is good to see.
Northern Idaho, Northern Nevada right now. I talked to an outfitter down there that's in that wilderness, that Jarbridge wilderness. Mm-hmm. He's telling me that they're wet and green and it's awesome down there. And, you know, and then you turn around and read that Lake Powell's so low that, you know, they can't even launch a boat in some spots. Yeah. And so Southern Nevada may be super dry.
So it's really a regional or even more specific thing now. But initially, the, like in March, it was looking pretty bleak. But now it's starting to pick up in space.
May. Well, we had the third or fourth wettest May on record for our area. And June was wetter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean,
yep.
So it's pretty intense for different areas. And you said all of that information's on Tag Hub.
Yes, every quarter we update the drought information. You know, that's one that we talked about. Could we do it every week? Could we do it every month? And, you know, that's one data set that you can't do a lot about. There's not really a lot of actionable items. And, you know, so we said, okay, we're going to do this every quarter so people understand that, okay, what's the snowpack look like? Because that also affects hunt conditions. Like if you're a DIY backpack hunter, knowing that there's enough water going into your area, that makes a big difference in the way you game plan. So that's just something to, you know, something to bear in mind, that that's why we did it that way. You know, another thing to consider when you think about drought, if you're in a drought area, because there are going to be pockets where, you know, the water table's still full and where water's coming out, definitely look at those areas for higher concentrations. And because what'll happen is, especially if you're a do-it-yourself public land hunter, people will tend to, got to go back to where I saw that buck or bull the last time. Well, drought conditions change things, meaning that there may still be that buck up there in that high country basin. And in normal years, you know, where it's 85-90% normal snowpack or better, that buck will stay up in those basins for 3 days, then go get a drink. Well, if it's drought conditions, he may only be up there once a week in that high country basin. The rest of the time, he's going to be down lower. And so you just got to be a smarter hunter in that regard. You need to know where to look, know where the water conditions are, and plan accordingly, because that can really affect the quality of your hunt. And drought, like I said before, drought is as much about the expectation for the hunt and planning accordingly based on conditions as it is all the other things that we're talking. And, you know, a few years back, actually in 2018, I killed a really nice buck, and it was a public land hunt. Ike Eastman and I went together. We hauled in llamas and shot this buck. But a fire had started just north of where we were. And then a second fire started. By the time we were actually driving out, there were ashes falling on us. And they never shut down where we were at, but we ran into a couple guys who had a horse camp in there, and they were coming up to pull camp. They're like, "We're not leaving our stuff up here. This very well could burn it down." So they were doing a quick ride up, ride back down with all their gear.
Wow.
So it's something to pay attention to for in season. Definitely look at what your drought monitors are and pay attention to all the signs when you're, you know, when you're looking at land and seeing those warnings on the highway. You know, don't let your buddy flick a cigarette if they're a smoker, kind of deal.
Yeah. So, yeah. No kidding. I mean, fire's bad, but that's good, but it's bad when it's in the middle of hunting season. It burns you right out of camp. So, yeah.
But to your point, Scott, there's a lot of like more microscopic things to look at while you're in season and either scouting or hunting to really pay attention to.
Yes, absolutely.
Yep.
Without a doubt. Well, Scott, we've got to wrap it up here today, but I really appreciate you coming on the show with us.
No problem. Thanks for the invite.
Oh, anytime. And I look forward to chatting with you some more in the future. I love to bounce ideas and topics off of you. And if there's ever anything I can do for you, please don't hesitate to ask.
Absolutely.
Keep up the good work.
Yeah.
Much appreciated.
Blessings, man. Have a great evening, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Sounds good.
Bye-bye. Folks, Eastman's Journal, like I said earlier in the program, has long been the foremost experts in public land accesses, tags, hunting, knowledge, information.
Generationally.
Like I said, Gordon and Mike and then Ike. I mean, the boys are, you know, carrying on the tradition, and I'm sure there'll be generations of Eastmans to come. And if you're a DIY hunter that's going to public land or just looking for information in general, Eastman's is, fantastic resource, something else I love to talk about is that there's additional information on the Far Wide website. You can research a lot of the same information, units, mapping, all of that stuff right on at farwide.com.
Perfect. So,
you can put things on the map and save it in your account and then open it up on your phone, and those waypoints are there. Cool. That's all the time we have for today's podcast, folks. But rest assured, we're going to be back with some more hot topics. There's a Second Amendment bill that I want to talk about. I'm gathering some information on. I talked to Ted. I told you I talked to Ted Nugent this morning about that. And, there's a lot of information out there that I want to get before I do a podcast on it. And I want to hear from a lot of people and help formulate my own opinion. Like I said, that's a topic for another podcast and a future day right here at the table we call Clark on the Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast. We'll see you then.
The Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast is sponsored by Farwide, the game-changing free app that puts outdoor intelligence in the palm of your hand.